Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Continuing our tour of the United States Geological Survey's volcano observatories, in this episode we head north to the state of Alaska. It's home to some of the most active volcanoes on Earth and one of the most tectonically active regions on the planet. In 1964, one of the largest earthquakes ever recorded wreaked havoc on Anchorage and the coastal communities of the state with destructive tsunamis. The same forces that generated that massive magnitude 9.2 earthquake also create an arc of volcanoes that make up the Aleutian Islands. The volcanic eruptions there are also a particular hazard to aviation since they align with a major route from North America to Asia. On December 16, 1989, a KLM Boeing 747 flying through the ash cloud of a Mount Redoubt eruption lost all four of its engines and plummeted more than 2 miles before, thankfully, the pilot was able to restart the engines. Monitoring the eruptive activities of Alaska's volcano is vitally important for public safety and a key to helping unlock the secrets of volcanism. It's a fascinating and beautiful part of our planet, and joining us to talk about it are two scientists that work at the Alaska Volcano Observatory. Matt Haney is the scientist in charge for the AVO, and Michelle Coombs is a research geologist who's had a distinguished career there as well. Matt Haney and Michelle Coombs, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you, Dave. Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Well, let's start with you, Michelle. Tell us about how you first became interested in geology in general and then volcanology specifically.
Well, unlike maybe a lot of people who get into studying volcanoes, I didn't start out as a real volcano nerd. I actually started out as a student just loving science. I went to college. I wanted to do astronomy. And my freshman year, I took an intro to astrophysics class, and it was pretty dry and pretty boring. And that same semester, I took a geology class with lots of outdoor labs, and I got hooked. And I became a geology major, got really interested in igneous rocks. Those are, granites and volcanic rocks and things like that. And from that, got into volcanoes in graduate school.
That's really interesting, Michelle, because I've heard variations on that theme many times with guests here who wind up being earth scientists, that they were very interested in, astronomy and the planets and everything. Then they started to take some geology classes and started to figure out that this planet here is pretty interesting.
Yeah. I think we're also social creatures and, you can be persuaded by just the environment you're in. And I was in a great geology class with a great group of people and going outdoors. And that sort of sold me, as opposed to sitting in a big lecture hall with the lights dim and talking mostly about physics, honestly.
Yeah. And what about you, Matt?
My beginning in volcanoes, it goes back a ways to actually a time I can't remember. I was young enough when Mount St. Helens erupted that I can't remember. I was very small. And my aunt, I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, but my aunt lived in Spokane, Washington. And when Mount St. Helens erupted, it put ash on her front lawn in Spokane. And she took a jar. I think it was like a jar of jalapenos that she'd used, and scooped up the ash and mailed it to my family in Memphis. And then when I got older, I remember, I had the jar, I had it on my my dresser when I was a kid. And so, from a young age, I knew it heard about volcanoes, even though where I grew up, Memphis, Tennessee, doesn't have any nearby volcanoes. And I don't see my aunt very often, but whenever I see her now, whenever she sees me, she says, "I knew you were going to study volcanoes because I sent you that jar of volcanic ash." So I can thank my aunt.
That's a great story. And I would, similarly to Michelle, I would say that I've heard that story many times too, that Mount St. Helens and that eruption in 1980 spawned a lot of people interested in volcanoes that became professional volcanologists.
Yes. And even at AVO, there are other people here who have their own jars of Mount St. Helens ash based on where they were or where others were at that time.
Well, let's talk about how you got to be at AVO. I always love that title, scientist in charge. I think that's one of the great job titles in the world, really. How did you come to be at the Alaska Volcano Observatory?
I was just talking about when I was really young. Later, I grew up in Memphis, and I got into seismology, the study of earthquakes. Memphis is close to a fault zone called the New Madrid Fault. It's several hours north of Memphis. It had some big earthquakes in the early 1800s. So in high school, I ended up, I worked at the Earthquake Center in Memphis. And so I got into earthquakes and then went to school and studied earthquakes. Actually, when I was in school, I just studied seismology, not necessarily volcanic earthquakes. But then after I got out of school, AVO was advertising for a postdoc position to come to AVO and work on volcano seismology. And this was about 15, 16 years ago. So I haven't really looked back. Really loved getting into studying volcano seismology. It's fascinating. And also being here in Alaska. And then after working here for many years, last year, I got the chance to be the scientist in charge. So now I get to not just do volcano seismology. I immersed in everything that the observatory does, all the science, the response, outreach. So it is, like you say, it's an amazing job. And the group here is just wonderful people to work with.
And how about you, Michelle? How did you get to be at the AVO?
Yeah, my history with AVO goes back quite a ways, actually. So after getting my undergraduate degree in geology in New England, and ended up going to graduate school at the University of Alaska Fairbanks to study volcanoes. And at that time, I became associated with AVO. And just as a little bit of background, Matt and I both work at the U.S. Geological Survey, but AVO has longstanding cooperative partnerships with the state of Alaska, Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys, but also the university. So back in the 90s, as a graduate student, part of my funding came from AVO, and I got to start studying volcanoes here and also helping out with the monitoring. I did that. I got my PhD. I went down and did a postdoc in Menlo Park, California, which at that time was a big office of the USGS. That was a lot of fun. I worked on the submarine flanks of Hawaiian volcanoes and did some ROV work and went down in a submersible. That was really fascinating. And I did that for a little while. And then I had an opportunity to come to AVO to work as a permanent researcher in 2004 here at Anchorage. And so I've been here for 20 years. And just before Matt was the scientist in charge, I did that for about 7 years. So yeah, it's been a great run. And I've been with AVO for pretty much my entire adult life.
Wow. Well, the AVO began in 1988. And as you said, it's a partnership between the USGS, the University of Alaska, and the State Geological Survey. It's interesting to note, those partnerships. Is that typical of volcano observatories within the USGS?
It is. They have partnerships similarly to AVO. But at AVO, the degree of cooperation with the partners is even more pronounced, and we're even more interdependent on our partners in our monitoring program and in our science and our research. So that part is really distinctive of AVO, how closely we work with the university and the state survey in Fairbanks.
Well, let's talk a bit about the reason that there are volcanoes in Alaska. Because it's very interesting. You have an interesting tectonic setting. And it's really cool. Nowadays you can use Google Earth and you can actually see, the bottom of the ocean. You can see that there is a trench there, the Aleutian Trench. And then, paralleling that just north of it is the Aleutian Islands and that chain of volcanoes. It's just such a classic island arc chain of volcanoes. Michelle, could you talk about, give us a little of the details of the tectonic setting, why there's volcanoes there in Alaska?
Yeah, so you just mentioned the Aleutian Arc, which is really the primary driver for why we have the majority of our volcanoes in Alaska. So listeners are probably familiar with the Ring of Fire, which surrounds the Pacific Ocean with a large chain of subduction-related volcanoes. So anytime that you have oceanic crust, which is being generated at mid-ocean ridges, so through the down the center of the Pacific Ocean, basically, with some complexity, and you have that new crust being generated, it needs to go somewhere. And so around the Ring of Fire, you have generally oceanic crust subducting or diving underneath continental crust, mostly continental crust, can also subduct under other oceanic crust. And so that beautiful arc of volcanoes we have in Alaska is from just that. So the Pacific plate is subducting northward, basically under the North American plate. And you get that chain of volcanoes. When the oceanic crust subducts, the pressure increases. That crust that's subducting gives off fluids. Those fluids kind of act like antifreeze in the mantle wedge above the subducting plate, causes mantle melting. That new magma is then buoyant, rises up through the overlying crust. And where that happens, sometimes if the magma makes it all the way to the surface, you get volcanoes. Most of our volcanoes in Alaska are caused by that process of subduction. We do have some other volcanoes in Alaska, which are a little bit different. So in southeast, there's a big fault there called the Queen Charlotte Fault. And we have some pretty interesting volcanoes along that fault as well. Some people call it a leaky transform, where a little bit of magma makes its way along that fault and rises up to the surface. One of the volcanoes we've been looking at a lot lately, Mount Edgecumbe, it's pretty close to Sitka, Alaska. It's been having an active magma intrusion. And so that's one that is along this leaky transform that we've been looking at quite a bit lately. So we have, and then we also have some volcanoes in interior Alaska, and then the Wrangell Volcanic Field, which is a huge volcanic field in Wrangell St. Elias National Park. And that tectonic setting is maybe related to subduction, maybe it's a bit confusing or enigmatic at this point. But yeah, mostly subduction with a little bit of other stuff thrown in.
Yeah, and of course, you know, going along with when you have a trench like that, you get large earthquakes and you get seismicity. And of course, one of the great earthquakes of all time was 1964, the Alaska earthquake there. So I know, Matt, earthquakes are your purview. Could you talk a little bit about the seismicity in that part of the Ring of Fire? And lately, there's been a lot of earthquakes along the Aleutian Trench, hasn't there?
That's right. Just this week, there were several earthquakes out in the area of Adak, Alaska, you know, far out on the Aleutian Islands. And it is just such a seismically active area. All of Alaska, especially this southern portion, as you mentioned, you know, the 1964 earthquake was the second largest earthquake instrumentally recorded. So there's that history of, you know, large, we call them those megathrust earthquakes. They're the earthquakes that happen right on that interface of the subducting plate. And so there was that 9.2 and the Good Friday earthquake, March 27, 1964. And there's also in the past century, other megathrust earthquakes going out into the Aleutians, you know, in the 1960s, also in the 1940s, you know, these big, you know, magnitude 8 and higher earthquakes, great earthquakes. And so that's happening in Alaska, of course. And then, you know, here, even in Anchorage, you know, for people that have been to Alaska or live here, you know, we'll feel earthquakes from time to time. And you know, sometimes they can become fairly strong. I even have at my house here in Anchorage earthquake insurance. I live actually close to a part of town called Earthquake Park. Mm-hmm. A earthquake-induced ground failure occurred in 1964. So the evidence of these earthquakes is, you know, here on the landscape. And those are the large earthquakes that are happening. Those aren't related to volcanic earthquakes. Those are small ones typically that happen beneath the volcanoes. So, you know, these large earthquakes, magnitude 8, magnitude 9, and then we can get other ones, magnitude 7, 6. But volcanic earthquakes typically are below the threshold of human feeling, even if we were standing at the volcano. They're typically magnitude 1, magnitude 2. So why is it that we are so interested in them? Well, it's not from the ground-shaking hazard like large tectonic earthquakes. The volcanic earthquakes are important because they're telling us the status of the magma that's beneath the volcano. If it's moving, if there's an intrusion happening deep beneath the volcano. So those tiny earthquakes, you know, we wouldn't feel them even if we were standing there. They are incredibly important to us to give advanced warning or advanced forecasting of intrusions beneath volcanoes that could lead to eruptions.
Yeah, I remember back in 1980 when Mount St. Helens, just before the big eruption in May, they were having constant seismicity, and they were calling them harmonic tremors, as I recall. And wondering why does that term actually mean, harmonic tremors?
Great question. So harmonic tremors, that's one of these types of seismicity we see at volcanoes. And the harmonic, it means just a single tone, almost like a tuning fork is how I describe it. So not like I would use the word broadband or non-harmonic signal, like most earthquakes are. In this case, with harmonic tremors, when we have seismometers on the volcano and it's measuring the ground motion, and we look at the data, it just looks like a single wiggle with a very up and down pattern that's it may go up and down every 1 second or so. So that's and it just goes on for, it could go on for seconds, minutes, an hour. So those types of harmonic tremors, that's kind of, just the tip of the iceberg of the types of unusual seismicity that you see at volcanoes. And so that's showing the richness of volcano seismology, that we don't just have little earthquakes. That was what I was talking about before, but we have harmonic tremors, we have explosions, we have other types of low frequency earthquakes that, make it so that to really understand what's happening at the volcano, it requires a lot of, background on various types of seismic signals. So at Mount St. Helens, I hadn't heard that, but it doesn't surprise me that they were having those harmonic tremors. And we have those in Alaska as well. And I also know at Mount St. Helens, I had heard that the eruption on May 18th, 1980, was associated with a large seismic event. It was, if I remember, something like magnitude 5.6. So that was, for a tectonic earthquake, that wouldn't be necessarily that impressive. That would be, magnitude 5.6. But for a volcano, that's an incredibly large earthquake. Usually volcanic earthquakes are small. If you have a 5.6, that's going to be one of the largest volcanic earthquakes, ever recorded.
Yeah, that...
Actually, in Alaska, in 1912, there was the eruption of Katmai volcano. That was the largest eruption of the 20th century. And at that time, there was one seismometer in Alaska, and it was in Sitka, which we were mentioning earlier. And from that recording at Sitka from 1912 and other ones around the world, scientists looked and they found that during the eruption of Katmai in 1912, there was a magnitude 7 earthquake.
Wow.
So, and that, to my knowledge, is the largest volcanic earthquake that ever occurred.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our look at Alaska's volcanoes with Matt Haney and Michelle Coombs from the United States Geological Survey's Alaska Volcano Observatory in Anchorage. I'm Dave Schloem, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our survey of Alaska's volcanoes with Matt Haney, scientist in charge for the USGS's Alaska Volcano Observatory, and veteran AVO research geologist Michelle Coombs. Well, Michelle, I'd like to talk to you about the types of volcanoes that we find in Alaska, because like where I live near Lassen Volcanic National Park, we have basically the four major types of volcanoes just within the small area of the park. We have the remnants of a stratovolcano or a composite volcano, very similar to like what Mount Shasta would be today, Mount Rainier, Mount Hood, mountains like that. We have shield volcanoes, which are what you tend to find in Hawaii, that have the more broad slopes, and a dome volcano, which has got very steep sides, Lassen Peak itself, and cinder cones, which are small, and they always kind of look like the classic, you know, kid drawing a volcano. That's what a cinder cone looks like. Well, what kinds of volcanoes do you find in Alaska?
The short answer is that we have all kinds. Even though, most of our volcanoes are related to subduction, that process creates a wide variety of magma compositions in Alaska. And it's mostly the composition of the magma that's really going to drive the shape of the volcano that results from that magma erupting. So you mentioned Lassen has that classic dome formation. That happens when you have very viscous magma with a high silica content. We have a lot of dome-forming volcanoes in Alaska. A lot of our higher threat volcanoes in the Cook Inlet area are that type of volcano. So Augustine on Augustine Island, Redoubt Volcano, both of those have erupted pretty recently in 2006 and 2009. So we have lots of other dome-forming volcanoes. We have some larger shield-type volcanoes. Those usually form when you have basalt magma that's really runny and fluid, and it has lower silica content, so the viscosity is lower, and the lava flows can travel very long distances. So you get that big, broad shape. Wrangell Volcano is a big shield volcano. Westall, Okmok, these are shield volcanoes. And then lots and lots of stratovolcanoes, that's sort of the classic subduction zone volcano where you get the layer cake of thick lava flows and pyroclastic flow deposits and debris flows, that kind of thing. Lots of volcanoes like that. We also have lots and a high number of volcanic calderas. So when you have very large, catastrophic eruptions and you evacuate the magma chamber under the surface, that can lead to the top of a volcano collapsing. And so we have a lot of really amazing calderas here, Aniakchak Caldera, Okmok Caldera, Katmai, which Matt was talking about, that erupted in 1912. It's one of the only historical examples of a caldera collapse. That formed sort of a smaller caldera, but the top of Mount Katmai collapsed in during that eruption. So, I mean, that's one of the great things about being a geologist here. We have lots of different magmas erupting and lots of different types of volcanoes.
Yeah, you've kind of got them all, don't you? Volcanic landform you could think of. And that's what makes it very interesting up there. You mentioned the silica content. And listeners can think of that as glass, because that's what glass is composed of, silica. Silicon and oxygen, silicon dioxide. When you have a lot of silica, that's how you get things like obsidian, and volcanic domes form from that. Those tend to be also some of the most dangerous volcanoes. Could you talk about why that is? What is the mechanism that causes those volcanoes, that type of magma that's not very runny, that makes for explosive volcanoes?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. So volcanoes can erupt passively. We use the term effusively, and that's when they erupt lava. And so listeners who visited Hawaii and they've seen lava flows at Kilauea, those are, generally less hazardous. When you have a volcano like Mount St. Helens, 1980, with that explosive eruption, that's where you have a lot more hazards involved. You can have ash that travels very far and falls on distant communities and impacts air travel. You can have pyroclastic flows that, you know, travel down the flanks of the volcanoes at very high speeds. So explosive eruptions are generally the more hazardous ones. And volcanoes tend, well, they all erupt because the magma is more buoyant than the rock that it's being stored in. And what really drives that buoyancy is volatiles. So by volatiles, I mean things like water and carbon dioxide and sulfur dioxide. And as magma rises, those volatiles come out of solution the same way, like if you have a bottle of Coke and you've got the cap on and you take the cap, you shake it up and you take the cap off, the CO2 in that soda is going to come out of solution very explosively sometimes if you've really shaken it up. So in general, that's kind of what drives volcanoes is, you know, the gas is coming out of the magma and forming bubbles. So to get back to the silica content or the silicon dioxide content, if you have very fluid magma and those bubbles are forming, the bubbles can kind of flow through the magma and just sort of escape. And when you have that kind of degassing, it leads to less violent eruptions. When you have very sticky magma, very viscous magma that has a lot of silica in it, and you form those bubbles kind of get stuck. They can't really escape from the magma. But as the magma's rising, the bubbles are growing and something's got to give. And so what happens is you can actually fragment the magma as it's rising. And that's what causes that type of explosive eruption is this fragmentation due to volatiles. And that mostly happens in your really sticky, silica-rich magmas. We call those kind of magmas rhyolites or dacites. So that's kind of a long-winded answer, but it kind of tells you why those higher silica magmas tend to be more explosive than basaltic magmas.
Yeah, they're very viscous. They're more like old toothpaste and compared to warm, runny honey.
Yeah. And it's important to remember, you know, that the ash that is the primary product of these explosive eruptions, it's basically just pulverized, quenched magma. A lot of it is the glass that you mentioned, but there are also crystals in there. So when we look at that under a microscope, we just see shards of glass and crystals that have just been fragmented and pulverized by this process of fragmentation and the magmatic gases trying to get out as they expand.
And of course, you know, one of the real hazards, especially in Alaska, for volcanic eruptions is, you know, since you mentioned it, when you talk about ash, it's not like the ash you get out of your fireplace. It's got those shards of glass in it. That's very hazardous for aviation, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the fireplace thing, because when we do outreach events or, educational events, we'll bring a jar of volcanic ash and a jar of fireplace ash, just so people can really compare and contrast, because volcanic ash is very heavy, it's very abrasive, and it's incredibly hazardous to aviation. So if that volcanic ash is ingested into a jet engine, for example, those engines are so hot that it can actually melt that volcanic glass that's in the ash and cause, as you might imagine, really extreme problems for aircraft. Here in Alaska, this was really highlighted in 1989 during the eruption of Redoubt volcano here in the Cook Inlet area. So Redoubt had a whole series of explosive eruptions in 1989 to 1990. One of those happened at night. It put up an ash cloud, and there was a jet coming into Anchorage International Airport, and it wasn't aware that that ash cloud was present, and it flew into the cloud. There's a really amazing recording of the pilot talking to air traffic control as this was all occurring.
Just slowly, so could the ash, is this a
It lost power to all four of its engines. It went into free fall. Extremely scary. Because the plane lost power, it descended very quickly. But in doing so, it descended out of that ash cloud. And in doing so, that brought back partial power to the engines, and the plane was actually able to land. But an incredibly scary incident that really highlighted the hazard that these explosive eruptions can pose. And that is in Alaska, that's our main hazard that we worry about. Most of our volcanoes are pretty far from communities and infrastructure, but that Aleutian Arc is right under the North Pacific air routes between North America and Asia. And a few years ago, we did an analysis that at that time, about 50,000 people per day were flying over Alaska volcanoes. So we don't want any of those planes going through ash clouds.
And could you talk about the role that the Alaska Volcano Observatory plays in advising aviation when, you know, this kind of event's going on? What's some of the protocols that go on where you let the aviation people know it's like, this is a hazard?
Yes, that is. You mentioned that relationship with the aviation community, and it's really our two primary partners are the National Weather Service and the FAA during these explosive eruptions. And so we've been doing this here in Alaska now for a few decades, you know, since the late 80s. And we have on average a couple of eruptions per year. So it's a really volcanically active area. So we get a lot of practice. And so when volcanoes are restless, we communicate, you know, Matt talked about volcanic earthquakes. And when we see the level of earthquakes or other signs of unrest go above what we call background, we'll communicate that unrest to our partners and, of course, to the public. Since the late 80s, we've used this shorthand. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's called the Aviation Color Code. It's just a quick way to communicate the level of activity at a volcano. So green means that the volcano is quiet. Yellow means that it's restless. Maybe it's having some earthquakes or has heated up. We're seeing that in remote sensing data. Orange means that the earthquake activity and other signs are pretty high. It might have an explosive eruption soon. And then red basically means it's having an explosive eruption. And so whenever we change that aviation color code, we have a formal call down list. And the first folks that we call are the FAA. The second and third are our Weather Service offices. And so the three organizations work very, very closely. And our goal, especially during explosive events, is to get that communication to the partners ASAP, you know, within minutes of the onset of an eruption.
Well, Matt, I'm wondering if you could kind of give us a rundown, or what are the really high threat volcanoes that are on the radar, as it were, for you guys up there? What are the highest threat volcanoes?
Yes, we have what we call five very high threat volcanoes in Alaska. We have many volcanoes, and those five very high threat volcanoes, three of them are close to Anchorage. They're in the Cook Inlet. The first one is the one that's closest to Anchorage, Mount Spur, which is about 80 miles to the west of Anchorage. And then the next volcano going down the arc, one we've talked about already, is Mount Redoubt. So Mount Spur, Mount Redoubt, and then further down in the Cook Inlet, there's an island volcano off the sort of to the southwest of Homer, Alaska, for those familiar with the cities in Alaska, and that's Augustine. So those are the three very high threats in the Cook Inlet area, close to Anchorage. And then the other two of the five are out in the Aleutian Islands. They are in in the vicinity of Dutch Harbor, Unalaska, which is a major port in the Aleutian Islands. And those two volcanoes, one of them is on the same island as Dutch Harbor, the Unalaska Island, Makushan volcano. And then the fifth very high threat volcano is the island that's just to the east of Unalaska Island, Akutan. So those are five very high threat volcanoes. They're the ones that, because of their threat, we have the most advanced ground-based monitoring on to give us the most advanced warning of any magmatic intrusions or other magmatic processes beneath the volcano. And kind of following on what Michelle was talking about with working with our partners at FAA and the Weather Service, just as an example, here at AVO in October, we had a tabletop exercise of a hypothetical future eruption of Mount Spur. So we met with the Weather Service over the course of several hours and went through all our procedures. And in a hypothetical eruption, you know, which group would have responsibility for this or that in our plans. And those plans and those procedures that we exercise now and that we have been working on over the course of many years, you know, I just wanted to, you know, emphasize those types of plans were not in place to the degree that they are today back in 1989, when there was that KLM jet that flew into the ash from Mount Redoubt. So those were early days and, you know, lessons learned over the years. Now with our partners at FAA and National Weather Service, we have, you know, a much more robust and worked out set of procedures that are ensuring that nothing like that will happen because of ash clouds in Alaska.
Let's take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll conclude our look at the land of fire and ice, Alaska's volcanoes. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now with our look at the volcanoes of Alaska with Matt Haney and Michelle Coombs from the United States Geological Survey's Alaska Volcano Observatory.
And these volcanoes you have in Alaska, they're fairly active, which means they have, you know, fairly regular frequency of eruption. Michelle, could you give us a sense of how often, you know, you have volcanic eruptions up there?
Over the last 20 years or so, we've had on average about two eruptions per year. And not all eruptions are created equal. Earlier, we talked about the great eruption of 1912 at Katmai Nova Repta. You know, that's the biggest eruption on Earth in the last 125 plus years. Most of the eruptions we have annually are much, much smaller. For example, right now we have one volcano in Alaska erupting. That's Great Sitkin Volcano. It's out in the western Aleutian Islands near Adak. It's been erupting continuously, a very slow eruption of lava since 2021. So really no hazards with that. So we have those kinds of eruptions. We have sort of small explosive eruptions. You know, we're dealing with them almost all the time, either some level of unrest or these minor eruptions. AVO and HVO kind of duke it out for which observatory deals with the most volcanic activity. Depends on how you, you know, categorize it.
HVO being Hawaii.
Exactly. Yes.
And, when we talk about volcanoes, it's interesting to think about, you know, the progress that we've made. You talked about, you know, from the 1980s to now, lessons learned. Let's talk a bit about the monitoring that you do, because, you know, things have gotten much more sophisticated. You've got more instrumentation. Could you just give us a sense of what kind of instrumentation you have on a lot of these high threat volcanoes?
Yes, at these high threat volcanoes, we have an extensive ground-based geophysical network you know, sometimes informally, I also, since I am a seismologist, I'll call it a seismic network, but it is really so much more. It's not just seismometers. It's also high-grade GPS sensors that measure small amounts of deformation of the Earth's surface. So those are important when you have a intrusion of new magma beneath a volcano. That's going to kick off a lot of earthquakes, and we'll pick that up on, you know, the network of seismometers. But then also the surface of the Earth will uplift slightly, and that can be measured. So having that type of measurement in addition to this, to the seismicity, is very important for being able to diagnose exactly what's happening. So we have seismometers, GPS sensors. We also have a sensor that's similar to a seismometer called an infrasound microphone. So it measures signal similar to seismic waves, except in the atmosphere. So we informally call them airwaves. And so we measure those on infrasound microphones. We say infrasound because the sound that we measure, the sound waves that we measure on those microphones, is so low in pitch or in frequency content that it cannot be heard by the human ear. So the human ear can hear down to 20 hertz, 20 cycles per second, but below that, we can't hear it. But volcanoes, when they are having eruptive activity, are prolific producers of infrasound. So we measure infrasound. We also at volcanoes in our network, we have remote webcams or web cameras. And so in clear viewing conditions, those can give us looks into the summit region or the crater to look at processes going on at the volcano. And then today we're, you know, improving the network, and we even have new sensors that are being deployed to volcanoes, such as real-time gas sensing equipment. So, you know, measuring gas at volcanoes in the past was not something that had a hardened, remotely deployed instrument that just remained in the field. Scientists would need to go out to the volcano or fly around the volcano and measure it sort of on demand when needed. But now in Alaska, just in the past few years, now we have two remote deployed gas sensors that's out at Cleveland Volcano in the Aleutian Islands. So measuring those gases, you know, similar to measuring earthquakes or deformation of the surface, measuring gas can also give us a piece of information for forecasting activity at a volcano. So we have these. We have over 200 of these installations. At a typical volcano, we'll have, you know, 6 to 8 remote deployed geophysical stations with these types of instrumentation on them. And it's, you know, it's a network that it came from very modest beginnings in the late 1980s, but also in the past 5 or 6 years, it's been fully modernized into a digital network. So it is a state-of-the-art type of monitoring network that we have in place now in Alaska. And so a challenge for the observatory is maintaining that. Every year, we have a field program where we venture out into the Alaska Peninsula, Aleutian Islands, and maintain these stations. So we have a substantial a field season that runs from early May through the end of September to make sure that all these stations are working 24/7.
And an interesting thing I saw is that you also at the AVO monitor volcanoes in the Mariana Islands. Can you tell us just a bit about that?
Yes. So in addition to the volcanoes of Alaska, we also, from here at AVO, we monitor the volcanoes of the Mariana Islands, which are north of an island called Saipan, which is the main island of the Northern Mariana Islands. And Saipan is itself north of Guam, which is not part of the Northern Mariana Islands, but is perhaps the most well-known island in this area. This is an island chain similar to the volcanic chain here in Alaska, out in the Aleutian Islands, that it goes north of Saipan and it's south of Japan. The reason we monitor it is it's part of the U.S. It has a status similar to Puerto Rico. It's a commonwealth of the U.S. And the type of volcano monitoring that we are experts in here, that we specialize in it at Alaska Volcano Observatory, is what I would call distal volcano monitoring. So we're especially attuned to and knowledgeable of monitoring distant volcanoes like we have in Alaska. And these islands north of Saipan are also similarly very remote. And so we use methods of distal volcano monitoring, like looking at satellite data or infrasound to monitor the volcanoes. An interesting part of the Northern Mariana Islands is that many of the eruptions there are under the ocean. So they're from what we call submarine volcanoes. We have those also in Alaska. We've in fact had a submarine eruption in the past 10 years in Alaska, but in the Northern Mariana Islands, it's especially common to have these submarine types of eruptions. And so in the Northern Mariana Islands, in addition to all the, you know, the types of distal volcano monitoring that I mentioned, satellite data, infrasound, we also look at volcanic lightning detections. That's another cool new area of volcano monitoring. But in the Northern Mariana Islands, we use hydrophones, which are, they're similar to infrasound microphones in principle, except they're under the ocean. So in that case, we use a permanent hydrophone array that's at Wake Island, which is to the east of the Northern Mariana Islands. It was actually deployed for nuclear test ban monitoring. But we have access to the data, that the data are available to the public as well. And so we use that data to also to monitor for explosive volcanism under the ocean in the Northern Mariana Islands.
Well, we're about out of time, but before we let you both go, I'll start with you, Michelle. What are some of the really interesting research questions going forward, things that you're really interested in learning more about with your volcanoes in Alaska?
Yeah, great question. I mean, as we talked about earlier, we have such a diversity of volcanism here in Alaska. You know, I think the underlying question is what drives eruptions? You know, why do volcanoes behave so differently from one another? Sometimes, you know, closely spaced volcanoes can have very different personalities. So, you know, my research really involves understanding how individuals volcanoes behave, how they change through time, what triggers eruptions. And I do that mainly by looking at the rocks that the volcanoes erupt. One thing I'm really interested in right now is just sort of building the community of volcano scientists to kind of help us tackle all of the research questions we have in Alaska. We have so many volcanoes that some of them really aren't very well understood. Like if you were to look up online how many research papers there have been on Mount St. Helens, for example, and compare that to your average Alaska volcano, I mean, it's just night and day. And so I'm really interested in kind of building our community of researchers who are, you know, intrigued and fascinated and want to learn more about our volcanoes to fill in some of those knowledge gaps.
And as briefly as you can, what about you, Matt? What are some of the interesting research questions on your mind?
My research, you know, it really kind of focuses in on, you know, details that I would describe it like the inner workings of explosive volcanoes, you know, the process of volcanic explosions. So, you know, trying to understand in detail what is occurring, you know, in the conduit itself of, you know, it's, of course, it's almost impossible to get, you know, make measurements due to the, you know, hazards of volcanic eruptions, but from seismic data, from infrasound data, what can we infer about those processes inside the volcano? And really, you know, getting back to your comment earlier about the harmonic tremors at Mount St. Helens, that type of, the richness of signals that you see at a volcano, not just, normal earthquakes. And so those signals, untangling, what precisely are they telling us about the processes that are happening at volcanoes?
Well, Matt Haney, a scientist in charge at the Alaska Volcano Observatory, and Michelle Coombs, a research geologist there at AVO. Thanks to both of you for joining us to tell us about the amazing volcanoes of Alaska.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks again to our guests, scientist in charge for the Alaska Volcano Observatory, Matt Haney, and AVO research geologist Michelle Coombs. You can learn more about their work and see the current threat levels of Alaska's volcanoes at avo.alaska.edu. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.